Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we'll talk about IFC's documentary parody series, Documentary Now. We'll go spelunking into unfamiliar docs ourselves. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Check out the NPR One app for your phone. As summer winds down, it's a great way to find new shows and stories for the beach or your road trip. Great hand-curated podcasts and stories are always ready when you are on NPR One. Find it in your app store, NPR One.
Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. What do you do at NPR?
I write about books, comics, and other stuff for the NPR website.
And at long last, by popular demand. It's so exciting. During a momentary break in a punishing schedule, with us in our fourth chair is Sam Sanders. Sam, what do you do at NPR?
I am a campaign reporter, so all around the country following the candidates, and I also co-host the NPR Politics podcast.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
It's fun stuff most days.
Oh, it's so
absolutely
good.
It is such a good podcast. You might have heard us talk about it from time to time, so welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you.
And one of the reasons why we thought this would be such a good week to have Sam on the show, I thought this was, I can say it was a stroke of genius because it wasn't me, is that IFC's series Documentary Now is returning with an episode called The Bunker. Now, if you're familiar with Documentary Now, it is a series that stars Bill Hader and Fred Armisen, and they essentially parody different typically famous documentaries. And The Bunker is a send-up of The War Room, which is the 1993 documentary about the first Bill Clinton campaign that introduced people to George Stephanopoulos and James Carville. So The Bunker features a sort of similarly attired candidate.
Sure.
Although perhaps more bumbling than Bill Clinton ever was.
Right.
And the two campaign operatives, Fred Armisen is the kind of Stephanopoulos-y kind
with
of
the
one
hair.
With the hair. And Bill Hader is the Carville-y one, which is interesting because he also used to do James Carville on Saturday Night Live. So, Sam, how did you enjoy The Bunker?
I really thought it was funny. I love how Hader really committed to that Southern accent.
Yeah.
He sounded so Southern, more so than James Carville.
Yeah.
I also love that they just went for the most absurd. You know, like by the last 5 minutes, you know this is a thing that would never, ever possibly happen in real life, and
right.
That's why it's fun. Yeah, it was nice to kind of contrast what I saw in this episode with what I see on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
Because so many times what I feel on the campaign trail is that a lot of these campaign staffers don't know what the hell they're doing.
Yeah.
And don't have a strategy.
Yeah.
And are making this stuff up as they go along.
Right.
Especially in the age of social media and new technology. Like, you literally don't know what you're up against until you're up against it.
Mm-hmm.
So to see this scenario in this plot line where these guys in charge knew exactly what to do, it was like, oh, that's cute.
Yeah. What'd you think, Glenn?
I really liked it a lot. On the Judge John Hodgman podcast, John Hodgman is fond of saying specificity is the soul of narrative.
Yeah, he does.
It is also the soul of comedy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this show, the idea of this show is so niche because
it
it's
is.
About
yeah.
paying attention to documentaries with a kind of fervid ferocity.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be mistaken in thinking that this is, they just parody some documentaries.
Right, sure.
There is always a sort of infrastructure of nailing the tone, the
mm-hmm.
approach,
mm-hmm.
but there's always within that something original. So it's not just parody.
Right.
It's more crafted than that.
Its own story.
It will have its own story.
Yeah.
It will have something that is absurd right there in the middle. I didn't like The Bunker as much as I like some of the others, possibly because I only saw The War Room, on which it is based, just the once. And this felt a little less sharp. We have seen a lot of political parody over the years, and this kind of hits some of those same targets,
mm-hmm.
but it's still a show that I absolutely love because it is so rigorous in its approach.
I just watched The War Room again recently. It's on Hulu, and there are moments in this that I had forgotten were specific salutes to kind of parts of The War Room. Mm-hmm. The part where they're all like standing around outside doing voices and stuff like that comes right out of The War Room.
Ah.
There is a moment in which Paul Begala is doing his Ross Perot in the original War Room. So it was nice to go back and see kind of how closely they really did track in certain places although the kind of the thrust, which is that the candidate is kind of a buffoon,
right,
is not the tone of the war room. Right. That's right. Not yeah. how those guys approached the war room or approached that campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think Glenn hit on that great point about specificity. And I think particularly when you're doing satire, when you are satirizing something in particular, when you are parodying something in particular, you have to be prepared to be able to do it as well as or better than the original. And if you can't do that, and we've talked about this a lot, you know, on the show about things like Studio 60 and the Sunset Strip, where they're trying to do comedy and they're not doing it as well as the things they're parodying. This show is very, very good at recreating the look and feel and style of the things they're parodying. They've clearly done their homework, and they've clearly done their homework in The Bunker, which I do think is just a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
Counting The Bunker, there have now been 8 half-hour episodes of this show. 2 of those are the same story split
right.
into 2.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 8 in all, and what I've found about this show is each episode is extremely reliant and specific to the thing that it's parodying. You don't have to watch these in any order.
No.
They are complete standalone projects, each one. And they're very reliant on what you think of each thing that they're parodying, how you connect to each thing that they're parodying. And so I've found there's a very clear delineation. I love this show, but I would only recommend maybe 5 or 6 of the 8. And I think there are a couple that fell really, really flat for me, in part because what they were parodying didn't have any resonance for me.
Yeah. One of the things that I remember really being amused by in the first season of this show is when they did their, you know, the promotional stuff kind of said, oh, this is Nanook of the North, mm-hmm. which is a kind of a famous black and white documentary. But the thing is, it wasn't Nanook of the North.
Right.
It was a later documentary about Nanook of the North. Mm-hmm. And that is actually what they emulated.
Huh.
Was a second documentary about a famous documentary.
So.
If you think the whole show is niche, the idea of doing a documentary send-up of a documentary examination of Nanook of the North, that is niche.
See,
that is niche.
That's my thing. I don't know if I could watch this show long-term because it requires a certain amount of work on the viewer's part.
Mm-hmm.
I have not seen lots of docs myself.
Yeah.
I knew this one because it's just part of the culture,
right.
you know?
Right.
But on any given episode, I could see myself not knowing what in the world is actually going on.
Right.
And I think to varying degrees, that matters.
Yes.
Yeah, to varying degrees. I mean, in the one that they did last season, that's a parody of the Thin Blue Line, or at least the Errol Morris approach
yeah.
to documentaries.
Right.
There is all of the window dressing, all of the music, all of the weird shots, all the slow movement.
Yep.
But there's also Fred Armisen being weird.
Yeah.
Which is always great.
You got
so
Fred
funny.
Armisen being this weird guy who nobody likes, and gradually over the course you come to understand that approach. But it's not, nothing is, he is a very, he can be, a very subtle comedian. And just the way he talks in
yeah.
this episode is, even if I didn't know what the hell The Thin Blue Line was, and it was a documentary about somebody wrongly accused, theoretically wrongly accused of a crime, you would still get it. You would still find something there.
Yeah.
Grey Gardens, which has an appeal to people who love camp and
sure.
To
yeah.
a gay community. The very first episode out of the gate in the first season
was Grey Gardens.
Was
yeah.
whole Grey Gardens. And it nailed the tone, it nailed the look, it nailed everything it needed to nail physically.
Mm-hmm.
But it also was just funny seeing Bill Hader wrap sweatpants around his head and be Little Edie.
Yeah.
I don't know if it matters if you know who the hell Little Edie
right.
is.
Mm-hmm.
It does to an extent and it doesn't.
Yeah. Because one of the things that's interesting that was interesting to me is that the one that I found the most compelling as a standalone story in the first season was the two-parter
yes.
that Stephen talked about, which is essentially a send-up of a documentary about the Eagles.
Yeah.
yeah.
About a kind of a 70s band called the Blue Jean Committee.
Mm-hmm.
You're right there.
That's awesome.
And their hit album, Catalina Breeze.
Exactly. And I will say, I have a Blue Jean Committee tour t-shirt that
wow.
was a promotional
What does
item.
It look like?
It looks like a 70s band tour t-shirt from kind of, you know, the Catalina Breeze tour 76 or whatever. That one, to me, I haven't seen the documentary
mm-hmm.
That kind of is their source material. And that one holds up for me just as its own
oh,
kind of tragicomic. It's like any musician documentary. They achieve success together, but then they sort of drift apart and one of them goes solo and becomes rich, and, you know, the other one kind of goes off and I think starts working in like a meat factory or something, a meat shop, butcher shop.
That two episode piece is, I think, their masterpiece. It is my favorite of their, of these projects. It's one I'm actually surprised they didn't spin off into a feature film.
Yeah. Well, we can conjecture that the reason that it's a two-parter is they found a story that they liked, or they hit on characters that they decided they needed to explore a little bit more and break it up.
The specificity of that one, also, like, I have not seen the history of the Eagles, but I know the story of the Eagles. And you clearly have, like, Bill Hader playing, like a Don Henley type. And it is amazing how much specificity is at work there. But they're also, they're like the Eye Doesn't Lie, which is the Errol Morris parody. It builds and builds and builds and kind of gets funnier as it goes along. And I think that the Blue Jean Committee thing, you really don't necessarily have to have many reference points at all to think that that's just a very, 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 very funny story.
To pick up on Sam's point, you watch this show always in the back of your head, the thought, who is this for? this happens to be for me, right? This bit right here, this is for me. But, you know, John Mulaney is also involved in this. He wrote the Bunker episode. Again, it's a very pleasing comedic sensibility, but it's so... You get this feeling when a really good joke that only you get, your reaction to it is large, but, you know, it's you're at the tip of the
triangle. Because you feel like it's speaking directly to you specifically.
Because it's invested, right, because you're invested in it.
Yeah.
Well, there are two episodes of the show that we haven't talked about yet, and they're kind of at the opposite ends of the spectrum for me. One, you have Drones, which is their Vice News parody, in which they basically send, like, these insufferable hipster bro self-styled gonzo journalists to find a drug kingpin in Juarez with the
hilarity
sort of,
ensues.
With the results that you would expect from that. And that it uses Jack Black to, I think, great effect. And then you have an episode called A Town, A Gangster, A Festival that is entirely rooted in like an Icelandic Al Capone festival.
Yep.
And that thing for me just sat there.
Yeah.
I finally was like, is it about like Santa Claus festivals? But it's Al Capone instead. That never built. There never felt like there was a joke to it except that it was about Al Capone. And so it really is, from episode to episode, a very uneven series for me.
Yeah. I do want to ask, since we have Sam here, I do want to ask Sam. I mean, I think this is an example of political satire on television with some of the same people who have been on Saturday Night Live outside of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
So how did it work for you as political satire?
It made fun of the stuff that you're supposed to make fun of, like people in campaigns that will do anything to win, a bumbling candidate who doesn't know his top from his bottom.
Right.
Like, it hit on all the things you're supposed to hit on. For me, what was the most compelling and when it really shone the brightest, when you saw Hader and Armisen basically doing a little kind of SNL style funny stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like when he's dancing like Michael Jackson outside, or when Hader's giving the speech once they've won and he says, I'm going to cry now. It's going to be weird.
Yeah.
Like, that's just like some SNL funny, like one-liners that pull it all together. Like, it's not that easy to poke fun at modern U.S. politics because it's all just so ripe. It's all right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So those things they did well, but lots of folks could do that well. But when they brought the SNL quirky craziness to it, that's when I was like, oh, this is really fun.
How have you felt like comedy has done dealing with this particular election cycle, given how, like, unexpected and bizarre it has been?
It's been really weird to see how we've failed to really kind of understand how to talk about the people that are supporting these candidates. Like, we don't know how to actually parody a Trump voter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're scared to offend, or we've never talked to those kind of people.
Yeah.
So what you end up is with everyone making fun of Trump, and no one talking about the people in the movement that have helped him rise up.
Sure.
Whereas, like, with Hillary, it all feels old because everyone thinks they know her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, they're still parodying the Hillary that was in the White House in the 90s. They're still parodying the Hillary from the War Room. They're still parodying the Hillary who ran in 08.
Right.
And in many ways, she's a different person now. And I don't think comedy and parody has caught up with it.
Yeah.
So I've been a little disappointed to see how no comedic thing has really gotten it right. And that said, the campaign itself is crazy enough and funny enough on its own. Like, just the other day, what was trending on Twitter? Trump can't swim.
Trump can't swim. Yeah,
what is that? Like, that gives you enough humor in spite of the lack of real comedic nuance around this election, I think.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. This is the kind of election where people say things like, oh my God, it's such a great election for comedians.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so funny. And I really, really beg to differ. It's much funnier for comedians if everyone involved is a stiff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can kind of get in there and you
project
know,
get
under the skin or project a persona onto somebody, whether it's there or not. When everything is loud and ramped up and subject to this constant commentary from comedians, but also everybody on social media,
right.
I think it's a much bigger challenge for comedians.
And we have these like two hovering meta questions around the election. Are you racist or are you sexist? You voter, you candidate, you this, you that.
Right.
So everyone's dancing around how to talk about that in a funny way. In the same way that like in 2008 with Obama, there was so much hand-wringing over like who would portray him on SNL. Because it was just loaded with years and decades of like race and stuff.
Which of these white actors will Barack Obama?
But they're both, and the other thing about is you also have two major candidates who have both been around so long as personalities that you feel like if you're going to find, you know, parody around Trump, a lot of people have been doing it since he was on, not only on The Apprentice, but since he was a kind of New York personality.
Exactly.
So it's sort of all the stuff about Huge and all that stuff. People have been
doing that.
And as you said about her, people have also been parodying her forever.
Yeah.
So it's really complicated. And in fact, one of the things about going back and watching The War Room was just seeing just how old some of these discussions are.
Yeah.
That Carville has a long rant where he's so angry about Roger Ailes. And this is in 92.
Yeah.
And he's so angry about Roger Ailes.
Yeah.
And you realize these stories, the story of the Clintons, the story of Ailes, the story of all this stuff, has been going on for such a long time.
Yes.
That finding like a new angle.
What's the new way in?
For political humor. And like you said, it's hard to do it around the movements that surround them because it's uncomfortable in both cases.
Also, the best version of Donald Trump is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
No one can impersonate that man better than he is who he is.
Right.
Like, he is the most gifable, vineable, memeable candidate for president that we've ever seen. Of course, he is the only one that came up in an era where all of those things existed. But, like, he's just so... His face gives you so much. His voice gives you so much.
Yeah.
Who could actually do a good Trump? Mm. I don't know.
I don't think I've ever seen anyone do a really good, really interesting Trump.
Yeah.
I mean,
necessarily.
If you remember in like episode 3, I think, of this show, I do, it, like well before Trump was a political figure, was making fun of him on The Apprentice and kind of doing a Trump, and it was just yelling. Like it sounded absolutely
yelling
nothing
about
like him.
Goulden's mustard.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But I always thought it was really, really funny the way he would do product placements on The Apprentice.
Yeah.
And it always started with like, Goulden's is a great company.
But
that's all there is. That's it.
That's Stephen's Trump.
That's the entirety of my Trump
impersonation. I think he would agree it's not nuanced.
But I think you make a really interesting point about trying to cover the movements around these figures. It's the difference, though, as a comedic person between punching up and punching down.
Yes.
And so if you're trying to do commentary on, you know, whether it's Trump voters, Hillary voters, any, you know, Ted Cruz voters, any number of people, anytime you're looking at the movements, especially populist movements that they come from, you're talking about everyday voters.
Exactly.
Whereas with these... You know, with these larger than life figures, you feel like you have to punch at them.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
There have been some good comedic coverage of this from your John Olivers, your Samantha Bees, your Larry Wilmores.
Sure.
But they are all coming from a very specific sensibility. It'll be interesting to see what happens when SNL comes back, because SNL, for better or for worse, is its broadcast. It's a wider net, and you could say the humor, the political humor, is toothless, or you could just say it's broader, significantly broader, and that not necessarily all coming from a position, or at least espousing a position like John Oliver does. So, what we get, who will be Trump when they, you know, bring out the Hillary thing again? I mean, it'll be interesting to see, because that is it's a good gauge for what the collective wisdom is.
Sure.
Yeah.
It reflects something because it is not going for the jugular, it's gentle. And that'll be interesting to see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, The War Room is available on Hulu if you're interested in that. The Bunker is coming back on IFC with Documentary Now. They've got, as Stephen said, a bunch of episodes that are already in the can and more to come. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about actual documentaries, perhaps some you've seen and some you haven't. So stick around.
A quick shout out to our sponsor who brings you this message, HBO, with the comedy series High Maintenance, exploring the private lives of New Yorkers through a common thread, their weed delivery man. Each episode features multiple stories about people from all walks of life through the series' patented brand of offbeat humor and pathos, revealing a city full of strangers united by the perennial pursuit of life's greatest highs. The hit web series comes to HBO with 6 new episodes starting Friday, September 16th at 11 p.m., exclusively on HBO.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In our first segment, we talked a little bit about Documentary Now, and now we're going to talk about documentaries. We thought that the way that we would get into this was that we would each pick a documentary in a subject area that we were not experts on. And so I'm going to kick it off. I'm going to go first to Stephen. Thompson, what did you watch?
Well, I watched the movie Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
And what is that about?
It is about a master sushi chef. Came out just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. I think Glenn recommended it on this show before. And what inspired me to seek it out was that it is going to be parodied on Documentary Now this season. Uh-huh. I saw that, like, kind of the upcoming list of the movies that they were going to look at. And I thought, what a perfect opportunity. I don't know anything about making sushi.
Yeah.
And it is a fascinating little film. And one of the great things that documentaries can do is they can take a very specific take at a very specific thing and paint a much, much larger statement around it. This is a movie about work. And it is a movie about craftsmanship and obsession. And so many great documentaries are about obsessives. Obsessives are interesting. This is a guy. He's in his late 80s. His little sushi restaurant, which is on like a subway platform.
Yep.
It's just this tucked away. It has 9 seats. It has 3 Michelin stars.
Mm-hmm.
So you're watching it. And at first you're like, this just feels like, here's a guy who is amazing at making sushi. His sushi is so good. I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, what makes it good? And then the whole rest of the movie fans out from that to explain what makes it good. And basically what makes it good is obsessive craftsmanship at every possible level. And I'm sitting there like, sushi's simple. It's a slice of fish and a little wad of rice and maybe a little wasabi. What's there to obsess over, right? But of course, the fish are painstakingly chosen, and you go to the fish market and you see what goes into acquiring the fish, and you see all this images of them treating the seaweed wrap by like smacking it against a grill. But it's just, each thing is more obsessively fussed over than the thing before, and you realize, like, this guy has been monomaniacally fixated on making the best possible sushi for 75 or 80 years. He left home at 9 and like became like an apprentice and studied his way up. And he's, you know, he's working with his children, and he's training his children, to his sons, to run their own sushi restaurants. But they, and it's really interesting how it takes this very, very, very simple thing and just draws farther and farther and farther out from it to make more and more statements about more and more things. I really liked the film a lot.
Yeah, and I think what's one of the things we're going to find in a lot of the really good documentaries is that the narrative that is their spine is very strong. This has a narrative about family, as you say,
yeah,
that gives you a way in. If you didn't know anything about sushi, you would have a way in, a very palpable way in. It also doesn't hurt that it's gorgeously shot.
Yes. I kept like pawing at the screen, like reaching out to the screen to try to eat the things that were set down.
And when they visit the fish market, you can just almost smell it.
Smell it, yeah.
You can almost smell it, and that one octopus crawls up the dude's arm. Oh, my God.
Ah.
Well, thank you very much. Glenn, I know what you watched.
Yeah.
I want to hear about what you watched.
My approach was to not only pick a subject about which I don't have any particular interest, but which I have developed a pitched antipathy. I am on record. In my humble opinion, sports are dumb and boring and loud, culturally inescapable. That's the thing I resent most about them. So I picked
culturally loud.
A 30 for 30 called Broke. 30 for 30 is this sports documentary series that you and everybody in this room has extolled to me many times, and I was going to do one about, like, this is a great play, and I just couldn't. So I did one about what happens to athletes after they retire. They go broke in huge numbers, in massive numbers.
And it's called Broke.
And it was good. It was fine. It didn't grab me, not only because of the subject matter, because it isn't really about sports. It's about people getting money and not knowing what the hell to do with it
and
making dumb decisions. I wanted some broad critique of the systems in place. That's what I was hungering for. I wanted somebody to slap these giant organizations down, and there's some of that. But it's a lot about individual choices that are just short-sighted because these kids are very young and they've never seen anything like this money in most cases, and they just don't know what to do with it. They're surrounded by family and friends who take advantage of them. They get took all the time. And the problem with it was it didn't necessarily have a strong central narrative. It's a lot of people talking to the camera in little bits. It's got a theme, but it doesn't have a narrative. Mm. It's got an idea. And I think what it's trying to say is, look how many people. And so you get a lot of different people. You get one, Stephen Nearden, near to your heart, I would imagine Bernie Kosar. Do you know a Bernie Kosar?
Football,
yeah.
That's why it's near and dear. Oh, because he played for Cleveland.
Yes, he did. And I kept getting distracted because, again, the stories were not necessarily grabbing me, but the personalities, I kept waiting for the personalities to grab me, and the personalities didn't necessarily grab me because I don't know who the hell these people are. But Bernie Kosar is the sweatiest testimonial, easily. It's not like he's like being grilled. Mm-hmm. He's just saying, yeah, I made some dumb choices. But there's a sheen on this guy, and he's sweating through his shirt, and it's just like, why? Where did you film this in a steam bath?
Yeah.
But it was okay. I do think it needs a stronger spine. I figured 30 for 30 meant 30 minutes, because that's how dumb I am. It means 30 different stories with 30 different directors. I get it now. That I get.
You're like, if I'm going to do sports, it had better be 30
And I would say, originally, it meant 30 stories about the first 30 years of ESPN. So it was related to the history of ESPN as well. I think Broke is a film where if you do have a little bit of context for the athletes, it probably means a little, it probably resonates a little bit more. Because I think if you have some idea of kind of who these guys are and how famous they once were, I think you get more of a sense of almost like by osmosis and by just accumulation, you get that systemic critique that you're talking about. Because when I watched Broke, and I talk about Broke, I mean, I bring up Broke with people relatively frequently when I talk about sports, because it does, to me, drive home that idea of how precarious a sports career actually is, even if it goes ideally. When you talk about stuff like, for example, every time sports conversations turn to concussions and things like that, I think about Broke. Because I remember how, even in the best possible ending of your sports career, it's a really kind of rickety place in which to find yourself. And it is a particular style, right? Every 30 for 30 is in a different style. This is in a pretty much entirely Talking Heads style. I think if you had, I know that you did the whole, like, I couldn't bring myself to watch one about a play. I think you might have preferred one about a play because it's more doc-like and less TV show-like. I think if you were to watch, for example, there's one about the day that O.J. Simpson had the Bronco chase, which was also a day the Stanley Cup, the hockey championships were over, and they were having the parade for the New York Rangers, I believe. And there also it was also Arnold Palmer's last Masters, as I recall, plus the NBA finals were underway. And it was all one night. And I think if you had watched that one, which is a little more traditionally doc-like, it has no narration. It's just clips. I think you might like that one. You might have liked that one better. I don't mean to say I think you might like that one better as if you're going to watch it. But I think you might have liked that one better. All right. Thank you, Glenn. Sam Sanders, what documentary did you watch, sir?
I watched a 2012 film called The Imposter.
Oh, seen it.
Seen it? Okay. Yep. I watched it. So this is a movie about a family in San Antonio, Texas, my hometown. Their 13-year-old boy, son, goes missing. For years he's gone, like 3 or 4 years. And then one day they get a call from Spain saying, "We found your son." But it's not really the son.
It is the most
kind of giving away the title there.
Talk about what the film is about.
So you learn more and more about the family once they bring this boy back 4 years later. There are possibly some secrets in this family. There's for sure a darker history to this family. They aren't all savory characters. And in some regards, the reason they want so much to believe that this person from Spain and or France is their son is because they need that to cover up some unsavory truths.
Right. Mm. And the reason why they don't immediately say, this is clearly not him, because it's not as if.
I mean, like, so the 13-year-old that went missing was, like, blue-eyed and blonde hair. Yeah. Wow. The dude that comes back from Spain is, like, Algerian. It's just like, what?
You look at him, it's not as, and it was only, like Sam said, it was only, like, four years or something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't 20 years. It wasn't a baby who turned up as a teenager.
It'd be
or
like
an adult.
If you went missing, Stephen, mm-hmm. and I came back. Like, for those who can't see, I'm black, Stephen's white.
Like four years later.
Yeah.
And so the other thing is, not only might they be, you know, eager to believe it's him or act like it's him because it's a convenient way to potentially say, like, okay, well, any unsavory truths that anybody might be inquiring about. And the film doesn't really declare what happened right. to this kid yeah. when he went missing, but it raises some kind of questions about what happened. But it's also like, not only is it like they maybe want to believe it's him, but they also are very wary of immediately saying that cannot possibly be him, because you don't want to make it sound like you know that can't be him right. because you know what happened
exactly.
to him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sure. There's a fascinating wow. question around this. I found this movie fascinating. I wrote about it when I watched it.
I want to see it.
It was good.
I wrote a lot about, like, do any of them / all of them really think it's him? Are they hoping it's him? Do they know it's not him, but they don't mind that it's not him?
Sure. For a second, I was like, oh, they know it's not him.
Right.
But they're glad to have this way out.
Right.
But then I'm like, okay, let's say that's the case. They're still bringing a grown man that they don't know
right.
into their house and saying, live with us.
Well, yeah.
And denial and grief can be easily
yeah.
intertwined. Here's my question about this movie structurally. Do they have a crew that happens to be documenting the search for this missing kid, or is it all hindsight?
I think it's hindsight.
I think it's all hindsight.
Does it have, like, recreations?
A lot of recreations.
Yeah.
I felt there was too much recreation.
I'm not a fan of yeah. recreation.
Also, they start interviewing the guy who is the imposter pretty early on. So they give away that big plot twist.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
So for,
they also called the movie The Imposter.
Exactly.
Right.
So like, for,
they're not really hiding
yeah,
the ball.
So enough. Like, for 45 minutes, I'm like, I get this. I know. And then twist. And you're like, oh, my goodness.
Right.
It's worth waiting for the twist.
Right. Because what makes the movie interesting is not that he's not the son.
Yeah.
It's, why are they doing this?
Right.
It's this mm-hmm. question of, like, why is it possible to come back, as Sam said, sort of like if Sam came back after Stephen disappeared.
Why is Stephen so much handsomer?
sort of like that. But the question is, what is driving their acceptance mm-hmm. of this idea?
Right. Yeah. So my biggest grief with documentaries is that they pretend to be just giving you the facts, but
right.
they're actually taking sides.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I liked that this one didn't really take sides.
Yeah.
If you felt like they just wanted to know.
Right.
Like, they just wanted to figure out what in the world is going on here.
Right. They talked to a guy who's been investigating.
Private investigator who was hilarious.
Private investigator who's very funny, who's been kind of investigating. And they kind of let him raise some of the questions
yes.
that they're trying to raise. And then there's other people who say no. And I agree with Sam. I
yeah.
think they try to kind of play
yeah.
fair with that.
And the PI is so awesome. There's like one scene where he's like, and I had seen somewhere on TV where, like, you can tell who's who by the ears. So I got a picture of his ears and I held it up. And I said, that can't be him. It was just like, it's so
he's got different ears.
Different ears. It was so funny.
It's really good, called The Imposter. Where did you watch it?
Netflix. Yeah.
The Imposter. I recommend that one too.
It's good.
I like that one. So I watched a film called A Lego Brickumentary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, uh-huh. Lego Brickumentary came out a little while after the Lego movie, when people were very infatuated with Lego and with animations around Lego. I expected more of kind of what Stephen was talking about with, like, enthusiast documentaries.
Right.
I like enthusiast documentaries. This is more like a promotional film.
Mm.
This, to me, felt like it could have been made by Lego.
Mm-hmm.
It feels very pitched for kids. It has a little talking minifig as the narrator.
Minifig.
Yeah, the minifig is the little...
I'm imagining like a fruit fig.
No. The minifig is the little figure, the little guy with the yellow head.
Oh, yeah.
And
they sell them in little packets.
Yeah, so the minifig that's talking, who's the narrator, is voiced by Jason Bateman. So the whole thing feels kind of kid-friendly, and there's sort of, here's the history of Lego. Here's how it was invented by this guy and how it became a sensation and everything. And then they try to kind of widen out, and they cover a whole bunch of different things. They cover these so-called AFOLs, which are Adult Fan of Lego. AFOL.
That's their version of Brony.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
AFOL kind of sounds like awful.
And they, but they, and the guys who are, it's mostly guys who are profiled.
The devil, you say.
They say, you know, one of them says, like, I don't know why we can't get a cool name. Like, Trekkie is a cool name. Like, AFOL is not a cool name.
It's not a cool name.
But it's, that, it's not, doesn't, it doesn't just sound like awful. It sounds like A-hole.
Yeah.
It does.
They, I guess, would prefer to be Leggies or something like that.
Oh.
Anyway, so it has some stuff about that and about these big cons that they have where they get together and they have build contests and things like that. Some of that is cool. There's stuff about like racing. They have like speed building.
Yep.
And they have blind building where you stick your hands through a thing and you can't see what you're making.
No
but
way.
You have to assemble a Lego thing.
So how is that different from master builders? Master builders is a thing, right?
Yeah. There is such a thing as a master builder. There are all these different categories and there are also a bunch of builders and designers and engineers who work at Lego
right.
who they profile, who spend their, you know, they spend their day playing with toys and it's that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all very like the wonder of Lego. And there's a little brief detour into a time in the 90s when they got so obsessed with these theme kits
mm-hmm.
that had special parts.
Right.
Like they would give you a whole head to go on the kit. And they talked about how some sets only had a few kind of pieces to them and there wasn't really any building. And so the company fell on hard times and it was this kind of extreme version of the kits rather than just the brick building. And that they kind of got back to the brick building, even though they still have the expensive kits, they're back to being focused more on the brick building. That's kind of a very like, they briefly forgot their soul, but then they remembered it. And
right.
it's kind of, I did read in the New York Times, Lego did not finance this film or make this film, but it feels like they could have.
Yeah.
And I wanted more of a, this world of Lego people, I need a little acid and sweetness balance,
yeah,
as any chef would tell you.
I would like that documentary to be about how stupid expensive those
kits are. Yes, I know. You do not love the kits. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and tell us about your favorite documentary, especially if you can find it on streaming. I found that one on Amazon. Many are available on your various services, and come and tell us about them. Now, when we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
A quick shout out to our sponsor who brings you this message, HBO. With the comedy series High Maintenance, exploring the private lives of New Yorkers through a common thread, their weed delivery man. Each episode features multiple stories about people from all walks of life through the series' patented brand of offbeat humor and pathos, revealing a city full of strangers united by the perennial pursuit of life's greatest highs. The hit web series comes to HBO with 6 new episodes starting Friday, September 16th at 11 p.m., exclusively on HBO.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Because it is the law that a great new TV show has to surface every week or two,
mm-hmm.
a great new TV show has surfaced in the last week or two. It is called Atlanta on FX. I'm sure we will inevitably at some point talk about it more on this show. But I started watching it. Stars Donald Glover. It's clearly Donald Glover's brainchild. It's really interesting. Like, they're clearly building to an epic story, but they're doing it a half an hour at a time. And so seeing them build up to a story about, like, struggling and finding yourself amid kind of the periphery of the hip-hop scene in Atlanta. Even in this episode, we talk about specificity a lot. And you really feel that Glover has done his homework on this project musically, scene-setting-wise, and just characters are unfolding slowly, but clearly very richly and very patiently. This is a show, it's just started airing,
mm-hmm.
but like you can feel like, at some point, I'm going to lose track of this show, and I'm going to be so happy that I did because I'm going to be able to binge a season of it instead of in these like 20-minute nuggets, which are so rich and satisfying. I can't wait to see more Atlanta.
I like that one. Good pick. All right. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
A couple things. First, as we tape this, I'm just back from Max FunCon, which is the convention thrown by podcast mogul Jesse Thorne,
yep.
where a bunch of the people from his podcast and people who love his podcast, I count myself among them. I met a lot of people, and it was a lot of fun. You, Linda Holmes, gave a keynote address that kicked 7 different kinds of butt. It was awesome.
Thanks, dude.
And I felt different than I do at Comic-Con. And that surprised me because what we're dealing with at any gathering like this is raw, unfeigned, completely sincere enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And one could write a book about how that's the key, right? Mm-hmm. The enthusiasm is what matters, not its object. So it should have felt to me a lot like Comic-Con. And the reason I think it didn't is because of what happens to that enthusiasm. At Comic-Con, it is channeled into buy something. Because Comic-Con runs both on the enthusiasm and the exploitation of that enthusiasm. It's a two-stroke engine.
Right.
Max FunCon funnels that enthusiasm back to the people who were there and says, create something. That's fundamentally different. It's such a resting, it was such a great experience. Now, that said, there was a dance party. And it was DJed by Dan Deacon, great DJ. A cheer went up. A raw, full-throated cheer went up.
I've done so much.
When the opening bars, when the horns kicked in, from the song You Can Call Me Al by Paul Simon.
Oh.
Over 100 people were in a room, and when the opening, when that came on,
oh man,
100 people said to themselves, oh, this is my jam, and ran.
That is a good song.
Onto the dance floor.
Now, I want to point out, I will say this, not just You Can Call Me Al, also Under the Sea.
Little Mermaid.
Oh, you know what though? I would dance to both of those.
Sure,
songs.
Sure. I just I merely note it.
I judge them so much more for doing the thing with Shout.
Yeah.
Shout is over.
It's
Stop
so
with
over.
Shout.
And then again, last thing is a lot of people left the dance floor when Shout ended and Call Your Girlfriend came on, and that's just you're doing it
How
wrong.
How dare
but
you leave the dance floor?
I know.
Absolutely.
I know.
I agree.
The second thing is something that just popped up in my Twitter feed recently. It's hard to explain. Back in the aughts, the Corn Syrup Council ran an ad that was all about how there's nothing wrong with corn syrup.
Excuse me? That has high fructose corn syrup in it.
And?
Yeah, you know what they say about it?
Like what?
I mean,
it's that it's made from corn, it's natural, and like sugar, it's fine in moderation.
The drag queen Jackie Beat made a parody of that ad.
So I have to pick up the dry cleaning, make a bunch of cupcakes for the bake sale, and then get the whole family over to the Robinsons' place by midnight for the cross burning.
Wow. You really don't care about your family, do you?
Excuse me?
Come on. The KKK's throwing that event.
And?
Well, you know what they say about the Ku Klux Klan.
Like what?
You know they're a bunch of hateful, close-minded, inbred idiots.
And that they're made from corn, have no artificial ingredients, and are safe in moderation.
It's fantastic. Unfortunately, there's a joke at the very end, a button, a tag that it doesn't really need. It's still hugely funny without it, but it's something to see. So that's the Jackie Beat parody of a corn syrup ad.
We will link to it. We will provide a link, because otherwise it's hard to find.
Very specific.
Sam Sanders, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
All right. There is an album, or I guess a new mixtape that I have been playing nonstop for about a week now. It is by a guy that I refused to take seriously for a while. His name is Young Thug. He is a rapper who is changing things. For the longest time, I couldn't understand what he was saying. He's heavily auto-tuned. He does this sing-song stuff. And I generally recoil at a rapper whose name is Young Thug.
Sure.
I already see enough problematic tropes of black men in the genre. This one just kind of was like, really, guys? But I gave this album a shot, and I must say I love it. So Young Thug as a character is really interesting. On top of this really hard-driving persona, he is gender ambiguous in many ways. The cover of his album is this.
Oh, yeah, we're looking at a purple dress.
Yeah, roughly fluffy purple dress with a big old purple umbrella hat.
Mm-hmm.
He often wears clothing not made for men. He has said before things like he doesn't believe that gender matters at all. Just so like, it's really interesting to see that kind of man rap the way he raps about the things that you think rappers rap about. I find with this album those kind of layers with him. So when you first hear this album, when you can make out the words, it's a lot of graphic talk about sex. And you're like, oh, this is just, you know, the worst, profane, whatever. Once you listen more and read more about it, he's actually talking about sex with his fiance, who he loves and has been with for a long time. So all of a sudden, it goes from being profane to strangely romantic, right? And even with the music, it's really, really bass-heavy, driving Atlanta hip-hop. And lots of times, that music, for me, can be bass for bass's sake.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very melodic bass. It's all very musical. The 808s have notes. And there's this one song towards the end called Kanye West. It's featuring Wyclef Jean, but
there's Kanye West.
And so the reason it's called Kanye West is he's named every song after his idols. So there's a Floyd Mayweather. Wow. There's one called Riri for Rihanna. There's one called Harambe
Floyd Mayweather?
Hey, his body, his choice. I don't know. But there's this moment in this song, Kanye West, featuring Wyclef Jean, that is this really rich 808 bass heavy modern hip hop take on like Quiet Storm. It's quite magical. And I'm surprised by how this artist that I had totally written off a year or two ago is actually really complex, really humorous, really inventive, really creative. And he's just doing things that I have not heard in rap in a while.
Hmm. Wonderful.
Young Thug. Check him out.
Young Thug.
Who knew?
Thank you very much, Sam Sanders. So before I get started with my regular happy, we are, as you probably know by now, going on tour on the West Coast in the second part of October. And although our San Francisco and LA shows are sold out, we have tickets for Seattle, October 17th, and then we have tickets for Portland, October 19th. You can get both of those at nprpresents.org. Those are going to be great shows with the wonderful Audie Cornish.
Yeah.
What's better than Audie Cornish?
Seriously, Audie Cornish is so good live. We say this all the time, but it's true.
She's great. We're going to have really fun shows. And as part of those shows, we are planning a segment where we offer up some pop culture advice. So we are soliciting your advice questions.
We're looking for like ethical questions.
We're looking for like consumption questions. Mm. So we have gotten some really good ones so far that are like, you know, when my spouse is interested in one thing and I'm less interested in something else, how do we navigate that? We have a bunch of interesting ones that have come in already, but we are still soliciting questions, pop culture advice questions. We're going to put a link to the form where you can submit your question on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/PCHH. We'll also put one on the blog, which is npr.org/monkeyc.
Yeah.
So come see us in Seattle. Come see us in Portland. Pop culture advice questions. Now, we have another thing that we need to tell you about, which is there is a, I'm just going to say, great, super fantastic lineup at the Now Hear This podcast festival, which is happening in Anaheim from the 28th to 30th of October. Mm-hmm. We will be doing our show on Saturday, the 29th.
With fourth chair, the one and only, Guy Brenham.
Holy cow. Holy cow. The Pop Rocket Pop Culture Happy Hour Singularity. Yep.
Many have hoped for that particular podcast, Voltron. Myself among them.
It is happening. We are assembling the Avengers. So we will be there Saturday the 29th, and it's going to be such a good festival. I'm super psyched to go to it in addition to performing at it. And you can get those tickets at nowhearthisfest.com. So come see us at any of those shows. That is the first thing in my What Is Making Me Happy. I, like Glenn, I'm going to mention something out of Max Von Kahn. Glenn and I were both out, along with our wonderful producer, Jessica Reedy. I want to call out the two comedy shows that the two kind of stand-up-ish shows that they had while we were there. One was Joe Firestone has a show called Friends of Single People, which she does in New York and I think has said she has done in New York and California both. And essentially, it's an improv format where several comedians speak in advance to real single people from the audience. And then they do like a dating game where the comedian plays you plays a version of you.
That sounds rough.
It's so weird. It's such a weird thing. And when it first started, because they play several rounds, and then at the end, they, you know, the person actually makes a choice. The person playing, the person looking for love, picks one of the people playing, one of the single people, and then they bring those real people up and introduce them to each other.
Sounds like my nightmare.
It's the weirdest thing. And when I first started watching it, I was like, I don't know about this, but it got funnier and more profane and explicit and crazy. But it turned out so funny.
It was awesome.
There were a bunch of people involved in it. Jordan Morris from Jordan Jesse Go was in it. Aparna Nancherla, who is a stand-up. Phoebe Robinson was in it.
Yeah.
Jean Grey was in it. A
yeah.
Whole bunch of people. It was fabulous. Joel Kim, Booster,
who
we love.
Fantastic.
It was all very funny. Also, they had a straight-up stand-up show featuring a bunch of these same people. Joel Kim, Booster hosted it. Aparna Ninchala was in it, Kevin Avery was in it, mm-hmm. Phoebe Robinson was in it, and Joel was in it.
Right.
It was really funny. And to have a stand-up show of that length that was so consistently funny throughout that had, to me, like, no bad parts
right.
is really difficult to pull off. I was super impressed with it. So thanks to Max Von Kahn, all of those comedians you can go out and find and enjoy. I recommend all of them. They were great. Absolutely fantastic. And thanks again to Jesse Thorne, who's the bee's knees. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Sam at Sam Sanders.
Yeah.
You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
Especially Sam.
I'm so happy to be here.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, an excellent guide to what's good in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews people like Elvis Costello, Rashida Jones, and Mike Judge about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts.